Hello, and welcome to Sorcery and Superstition, Episode 4. We had a bit of a break there. I changed up the programming schedule, and it may have messed with you a little bit. Sorry about that. But we're back on track now. We will be releasing every 2 weeks, still on Wednesday at 8 a.m. That's just to help get through the busy season that I've got in front of me right now, and make sure that I can keep these stories coming for you all. So, let's get into this week's episode. This week's episode is actually Youngblood. It was supposed to be The Salt Calling by Stephen E. Seal, but I had had some trouble getting in touch with him in time to release this episode. And I actually ended up getting in touch with him, so next week's episode will be The Salt Calling. But this week, just in time for Halloween, I had this one planned, is Youngblood by John Wallman. This will be the first horror story that we have on here. And it's a supernatural horror story. It's very interesting. I like it. In the interview portion here in just a few minutes, you'll hear John talk about more about the story and his inspiration for it and all that sort of stuff. And I really enjoyed reading it. And I'm sure you guys will too. I hope you enjoy the story. Here it is. All right. Welcome to the interview portion of our podcast. I'm here with John Wallman, the author of this week's story, Youngblood. Hello, John.
Hello, Brad. How you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Now, would you prefer me use my NPR voice?
No.
Use an NPR voice. I don't think I could maintain it the entire time, though.
It's harder than you think. Yeah, I know. I had to maintain a voice for a book recently, and it wore me out.
I can imagine.
So, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about the story?
The story is entitled Young Blood, and I was in the middle of writing the second book of my series, the Dark Manor series, the first of book of which will be coming out, we hope, in February of 2021. Just depends on how all the edits are progressing. Mm-hmm. But I was in the middle of that story of the second book, The Dark Harvest. Young girl, character, Alice Nightshade, came into the story, and that's not her real name. That's her coven name because she's an expat in France. Her parents are military parents. And so she's gone on this kind of, goth, vampire coven kind of thing. Cause there are actually people out there who lived this kind of alternate lifestyle called vampirism. Mm-hmm. And so she meets up actually, though, with a real vampire, and through a series of episodes ends up at that time being killed. Mm-hmm. But she later appears in the third book, The Dark Angel. So I had to go back and rewrite how she died, or actually write her staying alive and into the second book, because she kind of emerged into the third book.
Mm-hmm.
So in the meantime, so I'm writing about this Alice Nightshade, and I come across this article in nature.com about parabiosis. It's basically they connect the circulatory systems of two living animals, mm-hmm. Like conjoined twins. And they study how these body systems react to this kind of symbiosis. But what they did recently, and at this time in the whole process of writing the story, about 2015, a researcher had combined two mice together through parabiosis, one young mouse and one old mouse. And what they found out was that the old mouse started becoming rejuvenated, and lessening the effects of aging. And so I kind of immediately saw this as some kind of new kind of vampirism or whatever. Right. So and then Alice kind of popped into my mind, and I thought Alice, I could see her kind of seducing this young man into participating in some kind of parabiosis sort of clinic like thing.
Yeah.
And it kind of took off from there. And of course, then the song Youngblood came into mind too. The old song by I think the Coasters had done it years ago. But so I looked up the lyrics, and I was like, "Oh, these lyrics fit perfectly." But unfortunately, all the problems with getting permission to use lyrics and stories, I couldn't do that. But that song and this article and that old character Alice Nightingale, Alice Nightshade, kind of meshed together to form this story. And so I felt very compelled to write the story. And actually, Alice has come up quite a few times. I have another story called Stalking Shadows, which I'm not finished with. So it looks like at some point in the future, I might end up writing quite a few stories with Alice in it. She goes about recruiting young blood, quote unquote, into this kind of nefarious kind of modern vampirism, I guess you could call it. So
yeah, it was an interesting story. I read it already for prep, and I'm going to record it probably tonight. And it was an interesting story, and I really wanted to do it for this week coming up because Halloween is this week, and yours is the only horror-ish story that I have.
Right.
So yeah, it's
kind of sci-fi horror because there's a lot of science kind of thrown in there. That's a kind of a sharp edge to dance on. You know, you don't want to get too, you know, sciencey, but on the other hand, you want to keep pushing the story forward. Mm-hmm. And I also had in the back of my mind The Cask of Amontillado too, by Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh, yeah.
That kind of influenced things a little bit.
I could see that,
especially toward the end of the story. So,
yeah, I thought it was a fabulous story. And so what are your what are some of your big influences? Who do you enjoy to read?
Oh, gosh. Well, fantasy authors, for instance. Of course, Tolkien and T.H. White, Once and Future King. That was a kind of a seminal story for me. Really enjoyed the Stephen Donaldson, Thomas Covenant books. Guy Gavriel Kay, the Fiona Vaar tapestry. Good Lord, I could go on. Catherine Kurtz, her Dorini novels. Martin, of course, George R.R. Martin, Song of Ice and Fire. Michael Moorcock, Robert Howard, all those Conan books. I loved those when I was younger. I went through a whole dragon kind of phase where I was a lot of Nolan Ron and Anne McCaffrey and Barbara Hambly and of course Dungeons and Dragons, and I discovered that in college and I played that probably too much. The Dragonlance books and all that kind of stuff. So and that's just the fantasy side. Then there's a whole science fiction side too. Probably the thing got me started though with vampires, other than Dracula, when I was a child, because I watched all those Hammer movies and all that, was F. Paul Wilson's The Keep. I thought it was such a clever idea that he used in that story. It got me back. I went back and reread Dracula, and then I just started going into all kinds of vampire novelists, and of course Anne Rice and Brian Lumley, and Stephen King's Salem's Lot.
Yeah,
Martin even wrote a vampire novel. I mean, I just went on this huge roller coaster of reading all kinds of vampire novels and stories. Even recently with Dacre Stoker and J.D. Barker. With the Dracul, the sequel to Dracula, I've been kind of geeking out on fantasy, sci-fi, horror since I was a child, and I kind of grew up on Dark Shadows, back in the 70s and that sort of thing. So
okay, I haven't read a whole lot of vampire type fiction, but ironically, my
first book that I have narrated for money or whatever you want to say, you know, is a vampire book.
Oh yeah.
Yep. This is interesting for sure. I enjoyed it. I hope everybody else does. But it's kind of got re-sparked. It's kind of sparked an interest in vampire stuff for me. So it's been interesting. I've been reading a lot of stuff lately.
Yeah. I just gave you a whole lot of suggestions. Yeah.
I know, right?
And I could give you more if you want.
I'll be busy for a while.
Yeah.
I asked some of our other authors this. If you could choose one of these fantasy worlds to live in, which one would you choose?
Ooh, gosh. If I could live, oh, wow. If I were somewhat like, big and bad like Conan, I'd love to live in that whole realm, because, you know, the whole sword and sorcery thing was, when I was a kid, was really important to me.
Yeah.
The Durini novels by Kurtz, that whole kind of historical fiction or historical fantasy that she goes into with that. I really like that world too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I would want to live in Martin's Westeros.
A little dark, huh?
Yeah, they're just too much. Well, I mean, when you get into, when you think about all those high fantasy worlds, there's a lot of backstabbing and
right.
Dark characters. So, you know, you just have to be big and bad enough to deal with it and survive through it. So myself being a rather short fellow, and very nerdy, I would not, in my current state, survive in any of those worlds.
I am also rather short and nerdy, so I don't think I would do so well myself.
I could be sort of like a Merlin, and whispering in the ear of the king, you know, and manipulating the history that way. You know, I always thought Merlin was a really interesting character in the whole King Arthur saga. So,
yeah. For sure. Yeah, I had asked somebody else this question, and they said that, all these stories, it's right about the point where something really bad is happening in the world, so I don't really want to live in any of them.
Yeah, true.
There's great upheaval in whatever story we're reading.
The rise
here,
of some kind of evil, changing the course of people's lives and the history of that particular realm and all that.
Yeah, I always particularly liked Robert Jordan's world for The Wheel of Time. It was just so expansive with so many different cultures. And
I'm going to have to admit that I've never read any of those books.
Really?
I'm sorry, Reed. Listeners, sorry.
There's a lot of things that, there's a lot of different things about him, but that's one thing that he definitely does right. There's just so much culture, to so many different cultures and places. That world feels so huge that you feel like you could live and explore in it forever. Forgotten Realms is kind of that way, but they do it differently by having a whole bunch of authors writing.
Right.
One big world that they've all created together. So, let's get to the interesting portion here, right? The plug portion. You talked about your book earlier that's not published. Do you have any that are?
No, I don't. I have been working now for, it's coming up on a year now.
Mm-hmm.
On this series that I got picked up by Courage Publishing to work through the series.
Congratulations.
Thanks. And consequently, there's been a lot of revision. I mean, I don't think revision is something you can really explain to someone. It's something that you kind of have to live through.
Right.
You have to experience it. So, yeah, this whole revision process has been, tough, and that's an extreme understatement. So
you said you're expecting that to be out hopefully in February of next year.
Hopefully in February, if things go well, if not, then definitely by the spring. But we've been pushing this throughout this whole COVID mess.
Yeah.
And, actually a large part of the reason why it's not out now is because of that. But, It's given me time to actually work and refine some aspects of the plot that we've discovered over throughout the summer that kind of needs to be fixed, mm-hmm. if for lack of a better word. So
that's good.
Yeah. So it's like a good shepherd's pie. You got to put all those really good ingredients into it, mm-hmm. and put it in the oven and let it cook. And that's what we're doing right now. We're trying to let this baby cook so it comes out to be the best book that we can make it. So
excellent. Well, listeners, you all can look to the page, my page for sure. I'll try to keep in touch with John when his book releases. I'll put out some statements for him. Keep everybody abreast of what's going on. And I'm sure, John, do you have a page to follow?
Yeah, I have a writer page on Facebook, John Wallman hyphen writer. And I'm also on Instagram, author John P. Wallman. So I'm constantly updating, where I am in the process and that sort of thing. So,
all right. Well, there you go, folks. All right. And that'll be all for our interview portion. Thank you very much, John, for coming on here and talking to me.
Thank you, Brad, for having me.
Yes, I loved it. I love the serious voice. Yeah. All right, let me stop.
Youngblood. When they made eye contact, he should have heard, "Yellow alert," but he didn't. Now the girl smiled. He did hear the command, "Shields up." He should have turned and walked away, but he didn't. And when Wallace smiled back, that command voice, the one back there that's all sci-fi action hero, the one that barks orders at him to move, usually away from something, it should have become a frantic scream. The White Walkers appeared, and people started moving across the intersection, passing from the shadows of buildings into the morning sunlight. Not Wallace. The girl stepped into the street, in his direction. His feet did nothing. Normally, if a girl was within hailing distance, Wallace went into evasive maneuvers, which meant walking as calmly as he could in the opposite direction. The world moved around him. The action hero voice from back there had disappeared. That scared Wallace. He managed to look to his right. The red hand blinked. The backs of people moved away from him. He should be with them. In a few minutes, he should be on the city bus that would take him to the speech clinic where Dr. Supter would guide him through an hour of MPI exercises. It was the latest program his mother had put him in. He had tried them all. Lidcombe, fluency shaping, modification therapy, summer camps, winter camps. Now it was modifying phonation intervals, which seemed to work a little bit when he was in the clinic. Once he stepped out that door, and if he ever came close to a girl, Wallace looked back. Disaster was in his face, smiling. She stood on the street, he on the curb, so that he had to look down upon her. "I'd prefer not to get hit by a car, Wallace." She knew his name. "Red alert." He took a step back. "You can call me Alice." Wallace found the girl's eyes again. He could feel his legs filling with water, two balloons that would burst in a few moments. He wanted to say something, even stutter a "how" to begin the question that had come into his mind. But all he could do was stare at her eyes. They were purple. Contacts, he could see them clearly over her irises. This realization released him, and he scanned down her neck. Her skin was lily white. She wore a leather jacket over a French blue blouse, so tight that the button seemed close to popping off. The tops of her white breast pushed up as if to say, "Look at us." And Wallace did, a few moments too long. Her smile widened, and he blushed. "Nightshade," she added. "I am Alice Nightshade, and you are Wallace Evers." She held out a hand to shake. It halted half a moment, then continued to his face. Her cool fingers moved a lock of hair that had come down between his eyes, like the 10,000 times his mother had. His mother's touch didn't affect him like Alice's. He wanted to ask her how she knew his name. "I see you every time you're at the clinic," her hand alighted on his shoulder. I go there too. We must have the same schedules, though I've never tried MPI. She leaned close as if to tell a secret. I'll see how well you do before I try it. Why did she need it? She spoke perfectly, naturally. What was happening? Why was this... Yes, she was beautiful. Why was she talking to him? Seeming to read his mind. Alice's face became serious. I see something in you, Wallace. You are very special. People told him all the time that he's special. His mother, at least twice a day. And she meant it. But she was his mother, and mothers always saw their children as special. Some of his teachers said it, but they were paid to be nice to him. Except Mrs. Stanford. She always had a smile for him, and said at least once a day, You're special, Wallace. Don't let anyone ever tell you differently. When she said it, it felt sincere, with an undercurrent of love. He loved her too. But this girl, Alice, she said it as if she were looking at a strange gem through a light, appraising its unique qualities, appraising its value. She took his hand. Come on. I want to show you something that will blow your mind. It was already blown. She gently pulled him away from his bus stop and the bus that had pulled up to it. Her smile invited a revolution in his heart, invited a promise of wicked independence, the salvation of a new way of life. All he had to do was break away and go with her. He took a step with her and saw the white flower stitched onto the back of her leather jacket. She was surprised a moment, then laughed. This? She turned, looking over her shoulder. It was the first Wallace had noticed her black hair. How straight it was. How stark her white hand was against it as she pulled the hair around her shoulder. The flower design was a series of three rows of broad petals, radiating from the center, overlapping like scales. Longer, thin petals stretched out like the major points of a compass, with curvy, thinner leaves in between these. The design encompassed most of her back, and by the look on her face, she was proud of it. It is the most beautiful flower in the universe, she stated. Wallace had seen it before, knew there was something unique about it. Alice turned and stepped closer. He was caught again by her eyes.
It is called Selenocereus grandiflorus, she whispered.
She put a cool hand on his right cheek.
It is the queen of the night.
Her hand moved to his mouth, and her index finger lightly traced his lips.
It blooms one night a year, then dies.
Those purple eyes, they reached into him, held him, caressed him. He wanted to know what was behind the purple contacts. What did they cover? Just like her name. He didn't care that it wasn't her real name. Wallace Evers was well-read. When she said her name, he recognized Alice from Adventures in Wonderland and Jim Nightshade from Something Wicked This Way Comes. Fantasies, like her. He knew if he saw what was behind those contacts, he would step into her fantasy.
Come on,
she said again, and tugged his hand. He smiled with her. Alice was a demon behind the wheel of her Triumph, TR7. Charcoal body, black trim, gray leather interior. It even had the steering wheel on the right side.
All authentic, she had said.
Her uncle had another in his fleet. A red one, but this was his favorite.
Can't shake a finger at this baby, she concluded,
and thrust the shift into fifth. She laughed and screamed with every squealing turn or acceleration. Wallace's gut leaped into his throat a number of times. She came to a sliding stop at the gated entrance of a long, straight drive that led to a building complex. Brick walls, 10 feet high, stretched away to either side. Wallace had been trying to study her during their drive. Alice was so intent on flirting with danger on every turn that she hadn't looked at him once. He was free to see her. She was all blacks and blues, and white. He marveled at the white of her skin, as if she had never been touched by the sun. Wallace decided the dark eyeshadow and mascara with the smoky lipstick were what made her eyes and teeth so bright. The black leather of her jacket matched a strip that ran the length of her jeans, which she filled nicely. She was on her way to being a goth. All she needed were piercings and tattoos,
Wallace noticed she had no holes for earrings. And she was pretty. Not beautiful. Her nose was long and her neck thin. She was wiry. But there was an allure about her that hinted of an alley cat, a graceful balance of danger and sexuality. Wallace felt like a mouse. He wanted to be a cat. Alice flashed him a grin like a kid who had just gotten off a roller coaster. His phone barked. It was one of the few risks Wallace had ever done in his life. Make his mother's ringtone a barking dog. She would have no reason to call him if they were in proximity. It was his one tiny defiant act, and it always made him smile. "You naughty boy, Wallace," Alice declared. She chuckled. The phone continued to bark. "Aren't you going to talk to her?" Wallace's smile faded at the question. The barking stopped. He took out the phone and looked at it. It yipped as if someone had kicked the dog. A text. They laughed. Wallace engaged the text. "Doctor says you missed appointment. Where are you?" He had a feeling that would happen. Alice put out a hand. "Let me." Her eyes softened, but her smile became a crooked line that said, "I know exactly what to say." He stifled a smile and handed her the phone. She thumbed a message and showed it to him. "With new friend. She's going to take me to dinner. Talk later." It was nothing like he would respond, and his mother would know it. It was perfect. He took the phone, hit send, and powered it off. "Friend, dinner." They looked at each other. Alice revved the engine, popped it into gear, and took off up the drive. The front of the main building reminded Wallace of a hotel. Except there was no marquee. No signage at all. Two valets, wearing black shirts and slacks and red ties, opened their doors. As Alice got out, she tossed her valet the keys. "Thanks, Neil."
"Sure thing, Miss Nightshade."
Wallace came around the car, looking at the structure. She took his hand. "I work for my uncle, and this is his clinic." "A clinic? With valet parking?" Alice waved at the mirrored front doors and announced, "It's a special clinic." And on cue, the doors glided open. An elegant man in his 40s, dressed in a black tux and red bow tie, escorted a wealthy older couple to the doors.
"X said, or however you say the name of this place, it was divine. We loved it, and we will come again,"
the woman replied.
"For a longer stay," the husband added.
They looked rested and healthy. There was something odd about them, a tightness that seemed contrary to their age. It wasn't Botox or plastic surgery, it was more. Wallace heard a car approach outside behind him. The tuxed man helped the woman with her gray Iskander cashmere coat, one much like his mother wore.
"David will see you two to your car. Thank you for coming," the tuxed man said.
He stopped when he saw Alice. His smile grew when his eyes moved from the girl to her companion. But Wallace didn't see this. He saw the large gold sign above the reception area. Exed Clinic. Exed, the lady had said. Wallace didn't watch much cable these days. He read. A lot. He quit purchasing new physical books when e-tablets came out. And the 208 books on his shelves today were ones he couldn't get electronically. He had 1,283 available to him in the cloud, many of which he had read at least twice. But that was half of his library. He liked videos. The Star Trek he regularly watched on his Blu-ray. He had all seasons of all incarnations of the show, and he had all the movies as well as the new flicks, the reboot, as they were called. And the X-Files, he liked that show too. Sci-fi and fantasy made up the majority of the 487 titles on his shelf. He loved the feeling he had when he went into his library and saw his shelves. All of them he had seen once, half twice, and his top 50 at least a dozen times each. One of his favorites was a show called A Study in Evil, about serial killers. There was something about the stories of these evil people and their methods of killing that thrilled him. David Berkowitz and Jeffrey Dahmer and Ted Bundy and John Wayne Gacy. But the interesting ones were centuries ago, like Giles de Ras or Elizabeth Bathory. And Bathory was the most interesting of all. She had bathed in the blood of virgins, reportedly killing over 600 girls. He remembered thinking, that's a lot of virgins. A lot of baths. Wallace took a particular interest in her, and he knew the name of her father's branch of the family. Etch, Wallace said, calling on all his training to speak without stuttering. Shed. The elegant man and Alice froze. She turned slowly to Wallace. Wallace still looked at the name on the wall. Etched.
Wallace?
Alice gasped, then stepped over to him, pulled up his hand to her cheek, then tiptoed up to kiss him on the lips. His heart burned.
Oh, you're very special.
It was all about Elizabeth Bathory. They didn't even try to hide it. And they used the English version of her name, which annoyed him. They even had a small museum dedicated to the Countess. Alice's uncle had traced his ancestry on his mother's side to the Exetti line, and that had led him to try to atone for the horrific deeds of that ancient cousin of his. He had made billions from chemicals, and now he used that money to fund pharmaceuticals to treat blood disorders and diseases. The museum didn't offer anything new to Wallace, but it did have a few artifacts that were supposedly owned by the Countess. Alice had to drag Wallace away. She promised him there were more interesting things to show him. The main building, called Paul, after one of Bathory's children, housed a hospital dedicated to blood diseases. They hurried through the hall to the back of the building and came to a glass corridor connecting two buildings, the sun now well into the afternoon. They approached Anastasia. Wallace knew this daughter had been Bathory's first child, but an illegitimate one, born when her husband had been away at war. The Count had taken the babe upon birth and had it, eltont, disappeared, wiped from existence. Wallace found it odd that a building would be named after a disgraced bastard. Alice used a retina scanner to get access.
This is where I work part of the time, she said.
There was a ding like an elevator, and the door slid open. They entered, and Alice pulled her black hair over her shoulder and removed her leather jacket. Large, gray, almond-shaped eyes looked at Wallace. They hung within black bat wings tattooed across Alice's back, shoulder to shoulder. Wallace had seen a few tattoos, but this was the darkest and deepest, like a birthmark. And the eyes, they were as piercing as Alice's real eyes. As she moved, the gray eyes seemed alive, moving with the flexing of her muscles and shoulder blades. Her entire back was exposed, and Wallace saw that her blue blouse was a halter designed for just this effect.
You're staring at me, Wallace, she said, and looked over her shoulder.
A spiderweb tattoo covered it and her bicep. He wondered how much more of her body was inked. He flushed.
Naughty boy.
She gave him a wicked smile before slipping on a lab coat. She held out one for Wallace, and he inserted his arm and pulled it on. They smiled a moment, and she reached up and pulled him to her mouth. Her tongue slipped in and slowly danced with his. He had kissed one other girl 4 years ago, and she had taught him Frenching. His body had trembled in fear then, but now, every muscle a volcano about to erupt. Alice released him and breathed.
Nice.
She moved the hair from his forehead.
Very nice.
Her hand dropped to his.
Come on.
They walked down a short hall and passed through double doors into a command center. It was empty of personnel, but seated four, one for each bank of screens along the walls, and one in the center at a desk station with two screens. These were the only ones on, and they displayed rows of data Wallace recognized as biosigns. One row, pod 21, blinked yellow.
This is perfect,
Alice said and went to the desk, touched the blinking row, and the screen changed to show all data for pod 21. Alice typed and touched, ignoring Wallace for the moment. A blue light emanated from a large rectangular window. He went to it and saw it overlooked a huge white room of white pods. Three rows of eight. Alice was at his side, pulling his arm.
Come on. We have to go down there. It's going to blow your mind.
Wallace should have been surprised when the pot of blue crabs appeared, steaming, the old bay aroma filling the dining room. Shrimp followed, then a large round plate of steamed vegetables. He heard Alice say something about how she had heard him tell Mrs. Crenshaw, the receptionist at the speech clinic, how he loved blue crab and shrimp, how he could eat it every day. Only a small part of him registered her voice. Most of him was still in the pod lab, still looking at the face in the window of Pod 21. Pod 21 had some kind of malfunction that needed Alice's attention. Nothing life-threatening. Something about a thermostat and ensuring the internal temperature of the pod was at a certain level. In retrospect, Wallace should have immediately wondered about her choice of words, life-threatening. Wallace looked in the small window on top. Someone was in the pod.
That's Mrs. Asobi. Her husband died 4 years ago. Poor thing. He was 10 years older than her. Parkinson's and Alzheimer's.
Alice spoke casually, while crouched down on the other side of the pod, checking its internal mechanics, poking buttons on a screen. To her, people in pods were an everyday occurrence. Wallace, however, wondered.
This isn't cryogenics, she stood beaming. This is much more.
She waved to encompass the lab and said the creepiest thing.
It's all about blood.
Bathory, blood, pods. Wallace expected the action hero back there to yell, "Red alert!" There was nothing but a strange buzzing. Alice came around the pod and entwined her fingers with his, like lovers. Then they came to dinner.
Earth to Wallace, she put a hand on his. Don't worry, it'll be explained. You can't talk science on an empty stomach.
His stomach rumbled. He reached for a crab. He had finished his third and was working on a handful of shrimp when he heard,
"So this is Wallace Evers."
Alice stood, wiped her hands, swallowed down her mouthful of shrimp, and went to the man standing behind Wallace.
"Uncle Joseph!"
He mumbled something about his jacket, but smiled and hugged her back. Wallace stood too, and that was when he saw it. How could he have missed it? It was big on the wall, 4 feet tall, 3 wide. It was a portrait of a young woman in a crimson bodice, gown and headdress, white kirtle, blouse and lace ruff. Her face was distinctly European. Tall forehead, long, narrow nose, round chin, thin upper lip and full lower. But it was the eyes that caught the attention. The painter must have used something in the white to make them seem to glow. The eyes. Wallace looked at Alice.
"You see, dear?" the uncle stated.
"You're both silly," she returned but smiled. "She's older than me by 400 years, give or take."
The uncle. He wasn't a real uncle. There was no remote resemblance. He looked like an English professor from the 1970s. Tweed jacket of browns and tans, with heather green elbow patches, heather green ascot cap, dark brown pants. He could have just returned from quail hunting on the moors. He was in his 60s, but the fuzzy gray sideburns made him look older. He removed the ascot and tossed it on a chest beside the door. Bald. If he were taller, he could have passed for Sean Connery's brother. And the dining room?
"This room was my niece's idea."
Uncle Joseph proffered his hand. Wallace took it.
"I agree,"
he added, reading Wallace's mind like Alice.
"It's an anachronism, but she's a Downton Abbey fan."
He shrugged.
"Where are my manners?"
Alice cut in. She stood next to Wallace. "This is Wallace Evers. And Wallace, this is Joseph Attenbrook. The richest name nobody knows."
Mr. Attenbrook released Wallace's hand.
"The way I like it."
He waved back to the table.
"Please, sit. Let's talk."
Wallace took one lingering look at the portrait, then sat.
"Alice is not her real name. You understand that, Wallace."
Mr. Attenbrook didn't waste time.
"And this goth look is dreadful. She used to be a beautiful girl."
The action hero was there, just behind his mind. Wallace concentrated and replied,
"Beautiful woman.
Alice looked like she was going to cry.
"I really like him, Uncle Joseph."
Mr. Attenbrook looked at the two of them, and he said to her,
"If you're lucky, Wallace, she'll tell you her birth name."
Wallace could tell this was a point of contention. He reached for a crab. Mr. Attenbrook did the same. The three of them ate silently for a few minutes, the weight of the older man's attack on his younger niece fading. Alice looked at Wallace. He at her. They smiled.
"Well," Mr. Attenbrook said, "I understand you know how to properly state my ancient family name. And you recognize the portrait. It's the original. I had it stolen and brought secretly to me in 1993. The few others who have been in this dining room had no idea what they saw. In comes a stuttering 18-year-old, infatuated with my niece, to upset the apple cart."
The action hero told Wallace what to say.
"She's infatuated with me, sir."
The older man smiled.
"True. She has an eye for special young men."
Wallace knew he was in the middle of a little feud. He had to be careful.
"She invited me."
Mr. Attenbrook looked long at Wallace.
"Other boys never made it to this clinic, let alone dinner."
Alice watched the two men duel. The uncle looked at Alice.
"What was the...
The past is the past." It may have been the most fluid sentence Wallace had ever said. He looked back at the portrait on the wall behind him.
"She is the past."
Mr. Attenbrook grinned.
"True, my boy. But Erzabet has recently become a part of the present."
He stood and walked to the portrait.
"The Fountain of Youth has been around us all along. She just didn't have the science and technology to do it right."
The action hero screamed,
"Red alert!"
What was this man saying? That bathing in the blood of virgins was a good thing? That Mrs. Asobi in Pod 21 was bathing in blood? What was happening in the pod lab? Alice saw the look on his face and half laughed, grabbing his hand.
"No, Wallace, it's nothing like that."
Mr. Attenbrook turned and smiled with his niece.
"What Ezrabet did those years ago was an atrocity. What we do here is much more humane. It is a science called parabiosis. I could bore you with details about blood proteins and growth factors and hormones."
He paused, considering his words.
"Listen, Wallace. I've been pouring money into this research for 20 years, and we have finally found the right cocktail of these proteins and factors and hormones that actually reverses the aging process. It all comes from blood."
He smiled.
"In a way, those elderly people in those pods are indeed bathing in blood."
Alice added,
"You saw that couple leaving when we arrived? The woman's 78, the man 84. They both look like they're 60.
She squeezed Wallace's hand.
"And that was after one visit."
Mr. Attenbrook reached into his pocket and brought out a mobile phone.
"I have a meeting."
He stood and looked at Alice.
"You are right, my girl."
He eyed Wallace and added,
"He is very special."
Then looked back at her.
"Perhaps too special."
"I am Alice Nightshade. Denise?"
It was a whisper in the back of his mind, echoing in the power blossoming within him. It frightened him, how his heart opened. Not his heart, his soul. A rising pressure that wanted to be freed, that wanted to express to the world he was alive. Witherman. He became the queen of the night. That beautiful flower, opening its beauty to the moon. He opened his eyes, an exploding supernova in the night. And the night looked back at him. The gray eyes of darkness leaped into the abyss that had opened when he bloomed. The core of his being where the light of his life burned. The eyes shredded the leaves and petals. It devoured his center. He was left with nothing. But the eyes. They looked down upon him as Alice arched back and caught herself on his chest, her black hair falling into his face. The soft caress of shadows. And behind it, the glowing eyes. The devouring eyes. They took everything he had to give. And when everything that was Wallace Andrew Evers was consumed, the eyes took more. He awoke in a white room. He sat in a wheelchair. His head felt like a 100-pound water balloon. If he moved ever so slightly, it would tilt and fall off his shoulders. His eyes moved down to his hands in his lap. They too felt heavy. His right pinky fluttered. He wore only his underwear. a clear tube, taped to his inner left thigh, ran beneath the elastic. A catheter. He took a breath. Two loud snaps of fingers behind him announced he was conscious. White double doors, like those to the pod lab, opened. The elegant man Wallace had seen at the hospital entrance, the one with the old, rejuvenated couple, smiled at him. He was no longer in a black tux. He wore the same tan, green, and brown as Mr. Attenbrook. Someone pushed the wheelchair into the lab and turned it right. His lab was much longer than the other. Hundreds of red and black pods, similar to the white pods he had seen earlier, stretched into the distance. The elegant man crouched down close to Wallace.
"She amazes me every time she does it. The tests say you are perfect."
His voice had the husky quality of age. Wallace strained to see the man.
"Oh, many pardons, my boy."
He stood and moved into Wallace's view.
"The neurotoxin has only begun to wear off."
His smile welcomed Wallace, disarmed the growing anger building in the boy. The elegant man looked behind and beyond Wallace.
"Do you want to do the honors?"
There were a few light taps and clicks from a computer. The lights in the room dimmed and turned red. The elegant man smiled.
"I love this part,"
he said. A pod moved out from the line in front of Wallace. It blinked and hummed towards them, stopping just behind the man. He hadn't turned to look. He had been watching Wallace. The pod, a kind of robot, rotated, clicked, and opened, like a coffin. It blinked, silently, waiting. Two technicians in white lab coats crouched down on either side of him. His left arm twitched. They stopped a moment and watched. This brought Wallace out of the shadows, as if Alice's black hair had been removed from his face, as if the glowing eyes on her back had closed. And there she was, standing beside the man. She wore a white lab coat. Something cold touched the inside of his elbow. His right hand moved. Wallace saw the tech was swabbing, cleaning his skin. The other tech cleaned the inside of his left arm. They were going to insert needles into him. The action hero was right there with Wallace.
"Be calm," he said. "Assess the situation."
They looked at the couple standing before him.
"Appeal to her," the action hero said.
"Denise,"
Wallace croaked.
The elegant man looked at her, astounded. But she only saw Wallace. She moved to the right, and the tech stepped aside. There was no remorse.
"I'm so happy I was your first, Wallace."
Something in her tone also said, "And I'll be your last."
"You have been right about a great many things. Nearly everything. That man at dinner. An actor. This is the real Joseph Attenbrook. He's 68 years old."
Mr. Attenbrook moved to the left side.
"And she is not my niece. She works for someone more important than me."
He smiled.
"In a way, my boy, you too will be working for that same person."
"It's all about your young blood, Wallace,"
Denise said.
She moved the hair on his forehead.
"We have isolated every possible protein and molecular factor in the blood of young people,"
Mr. Attenbrook said.
"We have tried every combination, every possible one. Nothing works as well as young blood. If we take your blood and, well, there are certain things we have to do to it. But if that blood is slowly circulated through and around an older person for 20 days.
"Mrs. Isabi, the older couple."
"Yes,"
Denise said.
"Look at Joseph. Look at him, Wallace."
He couldn't. How many young people had died so that he could be like that?
"They aren't dead, Wallace,"
she waved at the pods.
"They are sleeping. The blood has to come from a living person. Joseph won't admit it, but there is something."
She paused, considering her words.
"More in blood that comes directly from a person. Something beyond the biology, beyond the science, that contributes to the process."
"The soul." Denise smiled.
"Maybe." He wondered if they too had blossomed in the night. She kissed him on the forehead. I will love you forevers. His mother had said that to him 1,000 times. His mother. She would come looking for him. She will miss you. Mr. Attenbrook added.
All taken care of, my boy.
A needle attached to an IV line appeared in Denise's hand. She slipped it into his vein with ease. Wallace understood this young woman had not been Denise Witherman for a long time. She was, and forever would be, Alice Nightshade. The tech taped the IV line to his arm. Mr. Attenbrook was just as adept with the left arm.
I want him to stay awake for a while, so that I can visit him.
Alice leaned down and kissed Wallace on the lips. She smiled.
I owe him that, for what he had given me.
It had been more than sex. She had taken a part of his soul.
What?
Am I? Alice finished.
I am what you think I am.
Succubus? Vampire? She laughed.
Too many movies, Wallace. You will have plenty of time to think on it, my love.
The tech lifted him and placed him into the pod. Alice took the catheter tubes. There was another larger one coming from his ass, and connected them into the bottom of the pod. The techs connected the IV lines into the sides. They attached electrodes over his body and plugged them in. His right leg jumped.
He's coming out of it,
one of the techs announced. Alice caressed his cheek.
Just enough,
she told the man.
Attenbrook's face was inches from Wallace's. You're probably wondering why you. You see, my boy, our lovely girl here has a way of seeing the more in a person. She saw it in you. I'll be damned if I can figure it out.
She kissed Wallace again.
You won't die, my dear. Yes, you've bloomed, but you will continue to live, and your blood will bring new life to others.
One of the techs grabbed his head and opened his mouth, clamping it wide with some tool. An intubation tube pushed down his throat. A distant part of him wondered at how he had gotten to this. A pretty girl.
I see something in you, Wallace.
He wondered if there was a pretty boy.
You are very special.
He wondered how many of these pods were filled with young bloods. Alice had told him all along. She indeed could see there was something about him, in him, in his blood, that made him the right candidate for this. He laughed.
He's choking,
one of the techs said. The pod door came around. Wallace heard Alice say,
No, he's accepted his fate.
The door closed and locked. The pod filled with a fluid. He could feel it. It covered his eyes. Tiny bubbles rose from his face to a small window that allowed the only light he could see. She filled it. Alice Nightshade.
See you tomorrow,
she said. This has been Youngblood by John Wallman. Thank you all for listening to the podcast. This was a great story, and I really enjoyed reading it. It was different from what we've had so far, and I'm glad John contributed it. Little tongue twister. You'd be surprised how many times that happens when I'm reading, too. So, you guys don't have to sit through it there, though. I edited it all out. So, well, like I told you, next week is Assault Calling. I've got an interview with Steven already ready. And so, well, we'll be back. So, I look forward to you guys coming back next week, and I look forward to the story we're doing. I'll see you all then. Goodbye.